John Jennings just made Black History Month better.
I've created a brand new black superhero for Marvel. That's what it is.
Get ready to talk about cosmic superheroes, crowdfunding a horror anthology, and celebrating comics. Welcome back to listener-supported KPBS Cinema Junkie. I'm Beth Accomando. John Jennings has been a guest on Cinema Junkie multiple times. We've discussed ethnogothic horror, dissected Jordan Peele's Us, and unpacked the contents of Candyman. I love talking about horror with him, and I'm excited about his upcoming horror anthology called Shook. Jennings is a Hugo winner, Eisner winner, New York Times bestselling author, curator, graphic novelist, editor, professor, scholar, and design theorist. I get exhausted just looking at all he's doing on his Instagram feed. He'll be appearing on a panel about horror at Black Comics Day in San Diego on February 12th, so I'm using that as an excuse to chat with him again. John Jennings is professor of media and cultural studies at the University of California, Riverside. He's also the director of Abrams comic arts imprint, Megascope, which publishes graphic novels focused on the experiences of people of color. For his recent five-part miniseries, Silver Surfer Ghostlight, he drew on an old Marvel Comics character.
His original name is Dr. Albie Harper. He was created by Stan Lee and John Buscema and appeared in 1969 in a Silver Surfer story. Basically, what happens is Albie Harper saves the world. He gives his life to save the planet. And Silver Surfer is enamored by this and so humbled by this, he actually buries him and puts this cosmic flame on his grave to burn eternally to mark him as a hero. And throughout the Silver Surfer's, like, you know, tenure as a superhero in Marvel Comics, he often flashes back to this as a turning point in how he feels about the human race, right? I was going through this and I asked Marvel, I was like, well, this is a cosmic flame on his grave. Like, so if you know anything about comics, then you know the Fantastic Four got their powers from cosmic radiation, right? And I was like, this seems like an origin story to me. You know, why can't we bring this guy back? They said yes. And so I concocted this wild story about Dr. Albie Harper, and I brought him back as a black superhero, as a superhero called Ghostlight. And of course, the term Ghostlight comes from the theater. So a lot of theaters during the pandemic were shut down. And so they would leave the ghost lights on. The ghost light is left to show that the show is going to come back, that the show will go on. I thought it would be a great name for a new superhero.
I remember having the hardest time explaining things about Silver Surfer to my young son.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of, it's like really sad and existential on a
lot
of levels.
Yeah. He's a very like Shakespearean Hamlet-like, you know. Yeah, because he gives up his whole planet to set, you know, and he becomes a herald for this giant being that eats planets and called Galactus, and then he decides that no more. So he basically helps Earth not be eaten by this giant godlike creature, and in doing so is imprisoned on the planet for many years. He can't leave. Galactus, oh, you like these people, just stay with him. So he's kind of goes from like being enslaved to being a prisoner, you know. And I think because of that, a lot of black folk like really kind of projected onto that character. You know, you talk to a lot of black men, they really like the Silver Surfer. And I think characters like the Hulk or Beast or like Nightcrawler also get that, you know, as far as like the projection of a type of blackness onto their bodies, you know, because they are othered in a particular way, very visually, you know, or they're outcasts of society, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, that also seems to be part of the attraction with horror, because so much of horror deals with this sense of the other, either being afraid of the other or identifying with the other.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. There's a consumption of the other body that, you know, very much the technology of monstrosity is very connected to that idea, the consumption of these other bodies. There's a desire and a repulsion simultaneously.
Ghostlight is available now, with issue 2 arriving next month. I need to take one quick break, and then I'll be back with the rest of my interview with John Jennings. Welcome back to Cinema Junkie. As with Rodney Barnes, Jennings is a multi-hyphenate creator. Jennings, Barnes, and Kevin Grievous will all be appearing on a panel called Get Shooked, the New Masters of Horror at this year's Black Comics Day. The panel takes its name from the upcoming crowd-funded horror anthology called Shook, in which all three will have stories. I asked Jennings about the origins for Shook.
Well, Shook is a anthology of horror, very much influenced by old school like EC Comics. Just a little bit of background on that. EC Comics stands for Educational Comics. It was a company that was created by William Gaines, or run by William Gaines. I mean, he's kind of like a comics pioneer, but his father was as well. He's one of the founding fathers of DC Comics, actually. So what they used to do is they would do these morality tales, you know, but put them in a form of horror comics. So a lot of times they'd have like very short, you know, over the top, gory morality tales with an aha ending at the end. So if you've ever seen like Tales from the Crypt or ever heard of Vault of Horror or these types of things, then you're looking at what some of the aspirations for. But of course, some of the other inspirations, of course, are Warren Magazine's comics that they did back in the 60s and 70s. So Creepy and Eerie Magazine. Essentially, it's like the setup is like stories about morality that usually have like an interlocutor, like a narrator or something, right? So all of us grew up reading this type of stuff and being interested in this kind of stuff. I was approached by Bradley Gold and Marcus Flowers to participate in this. They wanted to do a Black horror anthology. And I had always wanted to do something called Shook. I thought it was a great title for something. You know, I had done a show actually in Atlanta called Shook. It's just like, it's something I wanted to do for a while. I wanted to do it as a horror magazine, but who has the time to do that? And so I don't actually. So teaming up with someone else seemed like the best thing to do. And so we decided to call it Shook, a Black horror anthology. And before you know it, we had a bunch of pretty high power, you know, African-American men who were interested in the same thing. Of course, as soon as I came on the project, you know, there were other people who were already interested, like Kevin Grievous, David Walker, I think had already signed up. The first thing I noticed was, you know, there were no women involved with the project. And I was like, what is going on, dudes? So, you know, the follow-up project would be all women, actually. You know, that we were cognizant of that. But it's a collection of scary stories by, you know, people of color, by Black men in this particular case. So.
And what is the appeal of horror for you? What do you feel that genre allows you to do that maybe you can't do elsewhere, or that connects with audiences in different ways?
Some of the first stories that we ever hear are scary stories, you know? Even if you think about stuff like mythology and folk tales that were told around a campfire, a lot of them are morality tales. It's like, oh, you know, the headless goat will get you if you do these things. You need to brush your teeth, or the spiny periwinkle, you know, we'll get you. You know, it's all like parents would do this kind of stuff to kids, get the hell out of them, like boogeymans and El Cucuy and all these different things. Like, they use them to actually like think about like, well, what's right and what's wrong. People are scared straight by these stories to a certain degree. But also, you know, they give us a sense of distance from social issues, like things that actually really do bother us. It's almost like being afraid in a safe space, you know? I mean, which one would you rather deal with? Like, the certainty of danger, you know, walking down the street as an African-American man these days, or watching Scream and Scream 2, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's the same reason we get on roller coasters, right? We like the titillation, we like to feel safe, but we also, you know, want to do it. It's kind of an escapist, and everybody's not into it. You know, that's the other thing. I think it's, you know, the predilection is, I've been into horror since I was a kid. My mother is a massive horror fan. We still talk horror and adventure stories all the time. She's still a big horror fan. Like, she'll watch anything multiple times too, by the way. Like, she's a repeat offender. She's like, if she likes a movie, she'll watch like 10,000 times, you know? And so will I, actually. And so, that's some of the appeal to it. I think as a creator now, because of some of the popularity of horror and social issues that has been spurred on by movies like Get Out, for instance, or shows like Lovecraft Country, they allow you to actually talk about, you know, these particular types of oppressive, monstrous things that have actually happened to people of color in our country with a certain amount of metaphor and distance, you know, and that's very appealing, you know, so it's just as a writer for me.
Well, and also, does that sense of metaphor and distance also make it more effective in maybe getting people who are not familiar with these issues or not aware of things like the Tulsa race riots or, you know, things that happened for real, using horror, is that a good means of kind of like opening people's eyes to real things, but kind of sneaking around and getting them to become aware of it?
I definitely think so. You mentioned the Tulsa race massacre, for instance. I was shocked at how many people had never heard of it, you know, until fairly recently. But the Watchmen television show, right, was on HBO. Which is kind of like a sequel to the comic book, The Watchmen by Alan Moore. And Dave Gibbons. So yeah, a lot of people responded to that because they thought it was made up. And so once they realized, like, oh my God, this actually happened in our country, it totally like shed a new light on things. So yes, you know, it is a really interesting way to teach the history, you know, especially since now that there's so much pushback against things that don't necessarily show our country in the most positive light. The truth of the matter is that most countries come out of like good and bad intentions. You know, our particular country, a lot of the capital that was used to create it was based on, you know, the enslavement of Africans. And that's the truth. You know, that's how we started. You know, that's not where we are now. But not telling students that, as far as like the background, I think is a disservice to, you know, the kind of underlying ideas. You know, everybody wants to be a hero. And a lot of times our country hasn't been, and that's the truth. So anyway, and sometimes that's horrific as well. So,
well, and you've been involved with comics where the comics draw a lot on real world horror or images from real world horror, like Box of Bones. And so I assume that this is going to do some similar things to that, drawing on kind of with these morality tales, drawing on some real world horror.
Yeah. I think it definitely seems to be so. I know for a fact, even though that David Walker's Blackenstein's, whatever he's going to call it, is obviously dealing with like issues around violence against Black men. I know Bradley Barnes's piece definitely is very anti-racist in how it's put together. My two stories, I have one story in there called, this one called The Breaks. And it's really about like the unfortunate demise of like pure hip hop culture. As I use, and also to, it's kind of a vilification of the Reagan era to a certain degree too. You know, about the AIDS epidemic and things of that nature. But it's not necessarily stated that way, but you know that a lot of that came out of just turning a blind eye to the AIDS crisis, for instance, during his presidency. The other story I did is an anti-domestic violence narrative. Yeah, so that's the other story. So it's both of them are morality tales to a certain degree. The first one is actually more of an elegy, I would say, about the death of a particular, or the shifting of a particular culture and basically how it changed the way we looked at the world, but also, you know, some of the things that actually kind of led to its demise in some ways, or like its, not really demise, hip hop culture is still around, but it's just like, it's just not what it was, right? And the other one is, of course, a very personal narrative about like just violence against women in domestic spaces, just why, you know, so.
And I saw you give a talk a while ago on ethnogothic horror. Mm-hmm. And explain a little bit about what that is and why it kind of needs to be separated out as a subgenre in horror.
And I've been kind of wrestling with this a lot too. Like when Stanford Carper and I were thinking about the ethnogothic, it was a reaction to the fact that when a few years ago, when Afrofuturism was coming to bear and actually was becoming a mainstream term, it started to seem like everything that was magical and Black, or like sci-fi and Black, was being pushed under Afrofuturism. It became like this big umbrella term, you know? And we're like, well, it was starting to issue genre, you know what I'm saying? Like for instance, something like Kindred, you know, I guess you could think of it as Afrofuturist. I tend to think of it as more gothic because of the tropes that are embedded in the story. You know, the idea of the doppelgangers there's mystical aspects, there's body horror, you know, there's this weird, like twisted love quadrant, triangle, I don't even know what you want to call it. That actually feels more like a gothic narrative, you know, and also too, like at the end of it, it's not necessarily pessimistic, but it's definitely not, it leans more towards a nihilistic endpoint, you know, at the end of it, it's not like, oh, we defeated slavery. No, it's like, no, slavery still pervades and it's destroyed this woman's life, the end, you know? So it's like, and so we're thinking about like, how can we unpack the demons and the monsters that actually haunt Black folk and move to an Afro future. So I'm sort of thinking about Afro future as a destination and not just a genre or like a cultural production method, right? So I always use Erykah Badu's song Bag Lady as an example. If you have the song, it's about this, Erykah Badu is watching this woman who's homeless, you know, who has all these bags that she's dragging behind her as she's trying to get to this bus, right? And so she said, you need to let those bags go. So it's a metaphor for like letting go of, you know, pain and struggle and things of that nature. In those bags, though, there's like, oh, here's Jim Crow is in that bag. And the Tuskegee experiments are in that bag. And, you know, all these different horrible things are in that bag. And you have to let those go. You have to name those things and then move to the future. So that we were thinking about the ethnogothic as a cathartic means to like deal with those things readily. Now, recently, I've been thinking about what I've been calling racecraftian horror, which I've been very interested in because, you know, you're familiar with Lovecraft and probably like Lovecraftian cosmic horror. I bumped into a friend of mine who said, you know what, if you think about cosmic horror, you can actually use the Black experience of racism as like the cosmic awe aspect of like Black horror, that kind of thing. It becomes this monstrous thing that seems inescapable and life-crushing, that kind of idea. I tend to not agree with that. I think it's super pessimistic. But there is this book by, there's two sisters named Fields, and they did this book named Racecraft. And it's about thinking about, or, you know, racism as a kind of spell. You know, they're like, it's kind of like belief-based, like witchcraft. So they call it racecraft, you know, in order for you to actually make it work, and actually you have to believe in it, even because it's a fictional structure, right? And so I was thinking like, man, what's a really interesting concept? So I took the fact that the Lovecraft man is Lovecraft, and I call it, created this thing called racecraft horror, which is kind of like if you take what they call the Afro-surreal, which is about the strangeness of Blackness in everyday life, and then mix it with a cosmic horror aesthetic to a certain degree. And that's kind of what I've been thinking about. Example, like Box of Bones, for instance, or Lovecraft Country. The comic book Bitterroot, I think, also does that. And then also things like Victor LaValle's really great novella, The Ballad of Black Tom, which actually remixes the horror at Red Hook and turns into this really interesting idea around remixing race through a Lovecraftian lens. So I know that was a lot, that was a big answer. I think it's a very utilitarian thing. I've been thinking about genre and thinking about theory around it for a while now, and because like it just keeps popping up and it's effective, you know, but like, why are people dealing with these ideas like this, you know?
Well, and it's also interesting you bring up Lovecraft because he's such a interesting figure for creating horror. There's so much about what he created that strikes a real nerve with everyone. But then, you know, he also comes from this place where he was xenophobic and racist and was
he was all of things. He's like, yeah, prototypical xenophobe, you know, classist, racist, sexist, all of the things, right? Yeah.
But what's interesting, what I find interesting about him is that he sort of turned all the things that were sort of negative about him into something in art that helped us to kind of see what could fuel those kind of points of view. And like, it's fascinating work. And I you know, but it is something that, you know, when you bring up Lovecraft, sometimes people, you know, push back or don't know how to kind of deal with him.
Yeah. It was funny. I remember being at a dinner party once in an art show opening, and I was talking to this art critic, and we came across, first thing we talked about horror, and you mentioned Lovecraft, and I mentioned this racism. She just basically, it's like, no, I'm just saying you're racist. I'm just saying that, you know, his work is racist and it actually permeates the work, right? Of course, as he neared the end of his life, his views started to change, you know, which I thought was really cool. I often think like if he hadn't died so young that his work would have shifted according to the times a little bit more, you know, but who's to say? But he does give us these tools to actually examine monstrosity and symbolism, right? I mean, so some things are actually overt, like his poetry about Black folk. He was not a very big fan back in the day. But the way that he uses metaphor about like what the monster symbolizes, the technology of monsters and the technology of the cosmic and that kind of thing is actually extremely smart. The other thing he gave us, of course, is the idea of an open source catalog of work. Like he actively encouraged people to write within his Cthulhu mythos. For instance, a lot of Cthulhu mythos were actually like perpetuated later, you know, by colleagues and friends of his, right, and other writers. So it's an open source creation space, which I thought was really interesting. A lot of people think the Necronomicon is a real thing, you know, because of that, right? It's not a real thing made up. Yeah. Anyway.
And because you're going to be coming to Black Comics Day, talk a little bit about kind of what appeals to you as an artist and a writer working in comics. What do you feel that it offers you that you're not finding elsewhere or that's exciting to work with?
Well, I mean, I feel like once you start making comics, it's in your bones anyway. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's a very, very immediate medium. And what I mean by that is you can actually, if you can make an image, you don't necessarily have to draw a comic. I mean, draw a cartoon or whatever. You can actually take pictures and put words to them and stuff. If you can tell a story in sequence and you can make a comic, you just take it down to your, you know, get to your copy shop or whatever and print up 20 copies of your little comic book and you become a comic book publisher. So the You know, it's that simple, actually. You know, of course, you might need some editing and some tweaking. You have different levels. But that's how, that's like zine culture, right? You just make something and you copy it and make it, you know, and that's really cool. The other thing is that there's no medium that speaks so much to the surreal as comics do. I feel like it's a dreamlike, you know, space. I mean, film can have that quality to it, but for some reason, the way that comics do with symbols seems like so inherently smart and like recognizable to people. You know, it's something about the medium that actually relates to folk on a very visceral level. And the other thing is that everything on the page can tell a story, from like the line quality to the color to the typeface you use. Everything has symbolic meaning, and I think that's really interesting too. So it's a little bit like poetry to me. You know, I feel like comics is like poetry and a little bit of theater actually too. You know, it has a theatrical quality to it. You know, I think there's something to be said about the fact that back during the blog girl era, you would actually have chalk talks where people would actually draw, on the stage, like really fast, you know, and have these chalk talks. It's really interesting. Anyway, so yeah, that's one thing that appeals to me. I mean, I've been a fan of comics since I was a kid, and little did I know that it would turn into something that was part of my career. You know, my main career, of course, I'm a teacher, I'm a professor, but I do a lot of comics. Like I basically teach comics, I write them, I edit them, I theorize about them, you know, I publish them. It's just pretty crazy, you know.
And in revisiting kind of that EC format, what was that process of going back to EC Comics and saying, like, let's do an anthology series kind of like them? And did you feel that you wanted to tap into exactly what it was, or did you find new things that you wanted to explore kind of within that format?
You know, it's funny because I think some of the Black anthology is definitely inspired by EC, but we kind of went about our own ways and made and put the other creative teams. I sort of wish that we did have an interlocutor to introduce the different things, you know, but I could see us not agreeing who that would be. You know, yeah, me and my friend Stacey Robinson had this idea to do Southern, like Black Southern horror story. We wanted to call it Crazy Watermelon Tales. And our interlocutor narrator was going to be called the Scarecropper. And he's going to be like this little tar baby, like scary tar baby, like scarecrow creature, you know. But, you know, that was going to be fun. As far as like the things we learned from the form, I think we've been so busy trying to create it. The other thing too is they kickstarted this kickstarted the project too, raised like $52,000 to print, to make the thing. I think that was a lot of the focus. But yeah, I mean, I'm always thinking about the anthology format. I mean, I think it's a really smart format. It's definitely like a part of the backbone of genre fiction, I believe. You know, you find a lot of new talent there and stuff like that. And also it relates directly to the pulp aspects of it. But I think that the inspiration is not as direct as some would see. But I will say like something like the Shook logo is definitely inspired by the Shock Suspense Stories logo. It's kind of like it's derived from it. So that's pretty cool.
And in addition to writing and being an artist and being a teacher, you do a lot of curation of comics works. What are the challenges of that particular aspect?
Oh, there's so many there, because I found the biggest problem is that there's never been a space like the one we created at Megascope. And because of that, there's an overflow of so many ideas by so many people. We can't publish every day. It's a slow process too. Making comics is arduous. You know, it's very difficult. It's hard work actually, sitting down and drawing comics, you know. And so a lot of times, you know, we're backed up and, you know, we have all these projects coming through, and you have to read scripts and you have to, like, you know, look at your deadlines, and, you know, it's hard. I mean, I think we've been really fortunate. We've gotten out like 8 books so far since over the last couple of years. There's some books that are hella late, actually, too, you know, because people schedule shift, and, you know, once you get an advance, you don't get the rest of your advance and the book is done. And if you do a 250-page book, that could be a while before you get the rest of your money. It's just, you know, there's these kinds of concerns. Like financial, trying to keep morale up and keep pushing through. COVID was a huge, like, don't start an imprint in the middle of a global pandemic. Maybe that would help. But on the flip side of that, you know, we've actually had 2 Eisner nominations, you know, a Locus Award nomination, and now an Image, an NAACP Image Award nomination. So, you know, we've been making good books. We're just trying to get people to see. The other thing is like getting people to cut through the noise and see what we're doing. But yeah, I think that's going to happen too. So, but yeah, those are the main challenges.
And how does it feel in terms of the artists that you're considering and the talent that you're seeing come by? Like, what kind of things are you seeing that either you're finding inspiring or that, you know, you're interested in pursuing more?
Well, I'm always excited to see like different styles and different types of story ideas that are coming out of the BIPOC, you know, creative space, you know? Yeah, I just think like the sheer diversity is just wonderful to see. And don't get me wrong, I love superheroes. I think they're awesome, you know? But, you know, we've seen what that looks like, you know, from a particular standpoint. I want to see what that looks like from another standpoint. I want to see different drawing styles. I want to see strange books. I think comic books should be strange, personally. You know, I want to make the weirdest things. You know, you can do anything. So why would you just do something that's really simple and, you know, mainstream? Do something odd, you know? Odd and unforgettable. You know, that's what I'm trying to go for. But yeah, I think there's some really experimental work that's being done. I'm hoping that we can get it out. The thing, one of the biggest, this is another challenge too, is like, the balance between art and commerce is always a big issue, right? I mean, you can't make a weird ass book and then someone won't buy it. You know, this is really strange. I don't know if I like, ooh, this looks like Batman. I like it. You know, so it's that kind of thing. But it's like, okay, if I could get you to sit still and like really look at what we're doing, you'd be like, this book is kind of beautiful. Yeah, so those are things that are happening. And also another problem too that I've come across and something I'm really kind of struggling with is the fact that I'm a 52-year-old Black man. And I have particular tastes, you know, and you work with who you know. And so, you know, we need to diversify our diversity. I want to have more folk of color from various backgrounds on the line. But because when I think about like, oh, I want to do a graphic novelization in the Middle Passage, it's a very Black book, you know, it's about slavery and it's like magical realist slavery book, right? I want to get more things on the line. So that's why I'm inspired. I want to see like diversity of like creators that we can put through. Mind you, the other thing too is like we can only do 4 books a year, so that's also a challenge, right? So, yeah. Anyway, there you have it. It's difficult, but it's wonderful. It's a lot of work. We're doing some great books, but it's you know, it's a lot of work.
And tell me a little bit about the panel that's coming up at Black Comics Day and your co-panelists.
Well, I mean, they call it the New Masters of Horror. You know, we're just old heads at horror. You know, Kevin Greenius co-created the Underworld movie franchise, actually, the one about vampires and werewolves fighting with Kate Beckinsale, you know, that one. So he's like co-creator that. Ronnie Barnes is a award-winning television producer. He worked on The Boondocks. He's producing Winning Time for HBO. You know, he worked on the Wu-Tang Clan TV show, but he's also a massive horror fan. And he writes great horror. Like, if you read his book, Killadelphia, for instance, is fantastic. So, and he just put out Blackula, you know, Blackula graphic novel. He got the rights from MGM to do this. I'm like, what? It's crazy. So yeah, so I guess this is us talking about our love for horror and some of the same things we're talking about here. I was surprised. I didn't know they were going to do the panel. So I was like, oh, that's cool. I mean, the 3 of us who are doing this horror-related work, so it makes sense to do a panel like that. So, yep.
All right. I want to thank you very much for talking about Black Comics Day and about your own work.
Thank you. And I'm looking forward to finishing up that story so we can get it to press. So, like, along with volume 2 of Box of Bones. Anyway, so much stuff.
That was John Jennings. Issue 1 of his Silver Surfer Ghost Light is currently available at your favorite comic book store. Jennings will appear at Black Comics Day Sunday, February 12th for Get Shook, the New Masters of Horror. I'll be back tomorrow with my interview with Kevin Grievous. That wraps up another edition of KPBS listener-supported Cinema Junkie. Remember to check out Cinema Junkie's archives, including a collection of podcasts highlighting Black films and filmmakers over the past century. You can find videos and more podcasts at kpbs.org/cinemajunkie. If you enjoy the podcast, then please share it with a friend, because your recommendation is the best way to build an addicted audience. You can also help by leaving a review. Till our next film fix, I'm Beth Accomando, your resident cinema junkie.